So everything happens for a reason, but of course the big question is, what's the reason? And that's a very good way to look at this part of the Old Testament. We've just been covering the Exodus and the aftermath of the Exodus. The Exodus event was momentous. It casts a huge shadow on the rest of the whole Bible, even down to the present day. But of course, this momentous event had a purpose. So they're freed from Egyptian bondage, which meant they could leave. There's a geographic dimension to this, because at the onset of the Exodus events, God sends Moses to go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." Go. What's a good question whenever you hear the word go?
Where?
Okay. So, and that was a question Pharaoh had. And it was to go to the wilderness to worship God. But of course, we understand, and Pharaoh got it. If I let all these people go, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, they're not coming back. He knows that. They're going to belong to God, not me. And so we understand from a biblical standpoint, and the promise is they're going to go from Egypt to where? Via Sinai, but they're going to go from Egypt and out of bondage to where? The promised land, the Canaan land, their own land. It's going to become their land now. But here's the challenge with this, as we learn the Bible, what's happening in the events of the Bible. They get out of Egypt, but they don't end up in the Canaan land for another 40 years. There will be substantial numbers of people who will die between Egypt and the Canaan land. And so that brings us to this question: what is going on and why is it going on? What's the purpose to all this? And the answer lies in understanding what God's purpose is. It's not just to get into Canaan. It's to make them his people. That's the purpose. So let's jump into this and see what's taking place. We're really, our focus at this point is in the book of Numbers. But if you're doing the timeline from the packet, here's what we most recently covered. And that is the significant event of after the Exodus, they come to Sinai, and through Moses, they are given the law to live by. And the law makes them God's people. It makes them God's moral people. It instructs them how to worship as God's people. It instructs them how to be a unique nation, to set them apart from God's people, from the things they eat to the clothes they wear, that would make them a unique culture. And this is our third key passage. We looked at this the other day. So in this running list of key passages that we're tallying, there's five altogether. We've already hit three. And the first key passage is sin entering the world in Genesis chapter 3, and then the promises to Abraham in Genesis 12, and now the covenant that's made by giving the people the law and them agreeing to follow God and be his people, the covenant made at Sinai between God and Israel that's solemnized, I guess you could say, solidified, it's made official in the ceremony of Exodus 24, where they present the book of the covenant and the blood is sprinkled and they officially become married, so to speak, God and his people. So those are the most recent events we looked at, and now we turn our attention to this period called the wanderings, the wilderness wanderings, and we're going to just summarize this and look at the major developments. We're really looking at the book of Numbers, and the book of Numbers, this is a traditional name given to it because of what's happening at the first, and you see in the very first chapter, just scan over the very first chapter, it's a numbering. It's a counting of the people and a record of that organized counting. Well, what do you see in those numbers of Numbers chapter 1? What do you see in those numbers?
600,000 plus fighting men.
Okay. So if there's 600,000 plus men of fighting age, that means there are boys younger than fighting age, there are men older than fighting age, and there are females. Young and old. So that's where the rough estimate, and I have a hard time disagreeing with it, of 2 million people is pretty reasonable. That's a very common one by conservative scholars of Old Testament scholars. And I think that makes sense. Some people really have trouble with that kind of number. But of course, you know, when you see the problems they're having with food and water, you can see that it's a lot of people that are having problems. How would you feed all those people and water? That's a problem. You see that there. And they've got to trust God for it. So this is huge numbers. And it shows, when it gives the numbers, in what kind of organization in Numbers 1?
By tribe.
By the tribes. They're organized. And they know who's who, and they know how many of them there are. So things are really getting organized here when you see this. And so they're getting prepared to, and they start traveling in the book of Numbers. And they are organized into a camp. You see that in the early chapters. And so they camp according to tribes. They camp, when they camp, there's a certain place where the tribes go. When they travel, there's certain camps that move, or tribes that move first. All those kinds of things. And important to them now, as they travel, is the care of the tabernacle. So hopefully you looked at the video that Ken and I sent you this past week. If not, you can look at it sometime in the coming week. And more details there are given about the tabernacle. Bottom line, what did the tabernacle symbolize as it resided there among them?
God's presence.
Presence of God. God's presence among them, even like ruling as a king. So they're going to take that tabernacle with them. They have a sequence in how they pack it up. This is where the Levites come in. So of the tribe of Levi, these are the men who work in and around the tabernacle, assisting in the worship, as far as also packing it up and carrying all the goods in the tabernacle. And then the priests, who are of the tribe of Levi, but of the descendants of Aaron, are those who actually carry out the worship, the animal sacrifices, the grain offerings, going into the tabernacle and performing those functions there in worship. And so this is really getting detailed and very organized here, isn't it? And we see, and I want you to see something. In this organization is God's care. They know exactly what's expected out of them. They know the place they have. They know the function of everyone. How they worship and the place of the tabernacle. All this is for their benefit. And, you know, it's the difference between the kid stepping out the door to go to school and the, you know, mom says, you know, here's your lunch, okay? And, you know, I've got your clothes clean and all this kind of thing. And I think about these things because my wife teaches first grade and she's got kids. Parents don't do that. They don't send them out with clean clothes and clean bodies and food. And I'm sorry, that's a parent that doesn't care. They just don't care. They care about themselves, but not their kids. God cares about his children here. He's providing for them. You know, he's organizing them. He's looking out for them. You're going to need this. And here, I'm going to provide it for you. And so see that as God's care here in the book of Numbers. Well, this is the big event, and that is the sending out of what is called in most translations, the spies, which in a way, a more accurate translation would be scouting. Okay, but spies works fine. And so let's look at this here. And as we read these verses in Numbers chapter 13, 17 to 20, I want you to think about what this was for. What was the purpose of sending out the scouts? Earl, can you read those verses 17 to 20 to start with? Numbers 13.
Moses sent them to spy out the land of Canaan. He said to them, go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country and see what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. And how is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? And how is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort, then, to get some of the fruit of the land. Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes.
All right, thank you. So, what was the purpose of sending in these tribes, one from each, these scouts, one from each of the tribes? Was it to gather intelligence to see if they should or could take the land?
Yeah, just to see what it was like.
See what it was like. What about the issue of whether they should or could take it?
That was already decided. God said you will.
That was already decided. That was decided back in Genesis 12. 400 years before when God made a promise to Abraham. So this is not your typical military intelligence operation. Should we go in or not? This is, what are we looking at when we go in? What are we going to be facing? But of course, many people didn't take it that way. Yeah, Rick?
Well, and I think it was also a test of their faith.
Yep, as we'll see. Exactly right. So, let's look what happens here. First of all, what did they find when they go in this land? The next few verses.
People were very strong.
There are people in the land, and some of them are big and bad. They were of huge stature. What else?
There are fortifications.
Fortified cities.
And the land is rich, flowing with milk and honey.
Incredible produce growing in this land. flowing with milk and honey is an expression for how prosperous it was, how fertile it was, all those kinds of things. So, those are the facts. But I want you to understand whether they should go in or not should not have been determined based on that information. So, there you go. Look what happens next. Look what happens when they get back and they begin to report. Zachary, will you read those verses? Numbers 13, 25 to 33, please.
At the end of 40 days, they returned from spying out the land. And they came to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the people of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, "We came to the land which you sent, or to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And besides, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the Negev. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the hill country. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan." But Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it." Then the people went out and said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we are." So they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seem to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them."
All right, thank you. So there are two versions of a report. You've got 10 spies making one report. You got two others. Caleb is mentioned here. Caleb and Joshua are mentioned in the next chapter. So what are the two perspectives?
Well, I think they both say accurately what's there.
Right, right. It's prosperous but yet fortified.
But one is so let's go. Okay. What God has told us, the others are talking themselves out of it, you know, self-doubt,
okay.
Worry.
Okay. So one group says, it's a good land and there are strong people there, let's go. The other ones say, it's a good land, there are strong people there, let's not. And look over in chapter 14, verse 24. This is what the Lord says about Caleb. What determines the difference between these two groups of scouts? Verse 24 of chapter 14 gives us an indication.
He had a different spirit.
Different spirit. There was something different in Joshua and Caleb, a different outlook, and it says also a different spirit and has followed me fully. That means complete trust. Joshua and Caleb had complete trust and had a different outlook than these other 10 men. You know, later on, and it's understandable, later on, Joshua becomes such a prominent figure. He replaces Moses as the leader of the Israelites when they finally go in the land of Canaan in the next generation. And Joshua is a major figure and so important. But in this incident, the text gives preeminence to Caleb. You notice that in chapter 13 and 14. And Caleb still got this fighting spirit in the book of Joshua. He's an old guy, but he wants to give me a tough place. I want to take it. Okay? So Caleb is just a great champion for God. He really is. He's just one of those great characters. There are the two possibilities. And look at the reaction of the people. Not shocked here, are we? Daryl, can you read chapter 14, verses 1 through 12, please? Chapter 14, 1 through 12. Watch the reaction and look at the emotional intensity of this moment.
Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. And why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of the sons of Israel. And Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. The Lord is pleased with us. Then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they."
All right, thank you. So the majority of the people believe the report of the recommendation of the 10 spies to say they shouldn't take this land. And look at the aspects of the reaction. First, there's this mourning and weeping, this display of despair. But then that despair, they turn into a plan. What's the plan? We're going to get a new leader. We're going to pick a leader, and we're going to go back to Egypt. Oh, that's going to go well. Go back to Egypt after what had happened? Like, the Egyptians would just love to see him come back. The people that they blamed for the devastation of their whole land. I mean, they're not thinking straight at all, are they, about this? I mean, even if I had no faith in God, I think I'd take my chances in Canaan rather than go back to Egypt, okay, with the giants. But look what Joshua and Caleb were saying. Joshua and Caleb were saying those people that look like overwhelming opponents really can be our what? Prey. Because why? Because God. God's promised this to us. We're his people. He's going to help us. There you go. I mean, just what great, great faith they have here. Yeah, Dad?
I find it interesting back when they were comparing themselves to grasshoppers.
Yeah.
Well, grasshoppers are very destructive in the name of God, and they already saw that.
In Egypt, right. That's right. Locust. Yeah. That's an interesting way to look at that. That's great. So it's just all about perspective, isn't it? It really is. Yes.
Well, I think it's so interesting that in verse 11 it says, "How long will they not believe in me?"
Yeah.
These people believed God existed. Yep. You know, they had all the evidence he was there, but yep. It's saying here they don't believe in him because they're not trusting in what he's telling them to do.
Right. Yeah, and I'm sure you've heard this point made, and if you have, just pretend you have. But people all the time want God to demonstrate himself in a very dramatic, visible way, like with things like the Exodus, as if those demonstrable, supernatural, extreme events are automatic faith makers of any group of people who should have had no doubts about God. Should have been these people, but they still do. And so miracles are not automatic faith makers. I mean, look at the life of Jesus and all the miracles he did and all the so many people who were privy to it. So, great demonstration of that. Well, God is ready to do what with them?
Destroy them.
Wipe them out and start all over with Moses. All over. And starting in verse 13, Moses makes intercession. Okay? Starting in verse 13, Moses makes intercession for him and basically appeals that what will all the nations think? That you've just brought them out to destroy them. Moses really is as concerned about God's glory as he is in his honor as he is the people, but he's also concerned about the people. We've seen that over and over and over. So God decides to relent, but look at what God decides to do. Olivia, can you read chapter 14, verse 20 to 23?
Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. Because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it.
All right, thank you. So the consequence of the people who didn't believe that they could take the land is that they're not going to see the land. And look how God just continues to say this, but in a creative fashion and with more pointed statements. Rachel, can you read verse 26 to 33?
And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who are grumbling against me? I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to settle you, except Caleb and the son of Jephunneh and Joseph, the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses shall fall in this wilderness. You shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness.
All right, thank you. So, what were the parameters here regarding God's punishment of the Israelites? So, the ones who didn't believe that they could take the land are not going to go into the land. Specifically, what are the parameters here? What are the numbers? 20 years and older, which means this was comprehensive. And God knows who did have faith, and he mentions Joshua and Caleb. And what's going to happen to them? They're going to die in the wilderness. We're told later on that they're going to be in the wilderness for 40 years. 40 years. And that's going to give time for the people to die off. I mean, couldn't God just wipe them out immediately and then let the other ones go in? Well, it's a younger generation. They're not ready, right? And so this is all on purpose. Understand that here. And note this, too. There's an ironic statement. Yeah, go ahead, Gene.
It goes back to verse 2 where they said maybe you should just die in the wilderness.
They fulfilled their own prophecy. Exactly right. And here's the other thing. Here's the other ironic thing. What they say about their perishing actually is going to happen, as they said, you know. The other thing is, if we go into that land, they said at the beginning of the chapter, what's going to happen to our children? Back in chapter 14, verse 3, they're going to be prey. They're just going to be wiped out by these Canaanites if we take our children in there. God says, no, you're going to die. And he says, what's going to happen with their children? They're going to go into the land of Canaan, and they're going to be victorious. So, there's a whole sermon I have on this, but let me just give it to you in 10 seconds. As a parent, never look at the world and think your children will be spiritual prey. The world's just too awful. I've heard some people say that. I don't want to bring a kid into this world. The world's so bad. That is so unbiblical. Never look at the world and think, my kid's not going to make it. You're showing the same kind of attitude these people are showing. You got to have a Caleb attitude. God's with us and we can make it. Kid's going to have his own choice. She's going to have her own choice. She may choose to turn against God, or he may choose not to believe in God. But with God, they can overcome any challenge in the world. So anyway, that's that sermon. That was about 20 seconds. So, but that these are terrible parents because they don't have faith in God. And when I tell you, when you don't have faith in God, and I'm talking about a faith that dominates your world, dominates your life, and dominates how you live, your children will be prey to the world. Okay, let's move on to the next one. This is such an interesting, and it's a God ability here, that what he does is he blends several things here into the consequences. First of all, his reaction to the Israelites is merciful. What could he have done? Wipe them out immediately. But these people are going to have the rest of their life to reflect on this. So you've always got this working, and this is so true with and this is the role of the prophets. We're going to look at Isaiah this morning in the sermon. Well, you've always got this judgment that's being enacted on people, like the invasion of the Babylonians, or here the wilderness perishing over the next 40 years. Individuals in among the Israelites have their own individual choices. Yes, Babylon's going to come and wipe out Judah one day. But as a believer in God, how do I conduct my own self? The nation may perish, but am I going to get my own thinking right? And this is going to give these people 40 years of reflection, or so many years of reflection until they die. There's mercy in that. There's a lot of mercy in that. I've seen people who get a terminal diagnosis and it changes them. They just got a terminal diagnosis. Did you see that? Now what are they going to do until they terminate? How's it going to affect them? So there's mercy in that. There's also judgment in it. You know, you're not going to be the people who take this land. You don't have the faith. But there's an opportunity for renewal, because from this wilderness will come a generation that will be a very faithful generation of Israelites. They will take the land, and they will be very true to God's purposes for the most part. So they're going to, the wilderness will create a generation of Israelites that will have the faith that God's looking for. Earl and Rick.
Well, I was just going to say that if the older generation repents and lives the balance of their life with an attitude of repentance while they're in the wilderness, with that attitude, they can help prepare their children for what they will be facing when they go into the promised land.
Right. And you almost would think that that happened here when you see that next generation. Yes, great.
Well, and Joshua and Caleb have to experience the consequences of their judgment to a great degree as well. Yep. But they're still faithful.
Yep. And they want to stone Joshua and Caleb here. I mean, it was risky business for them to stand with God by faith, wasn't it? Then they're going to have to go through this wilderness experience. But you know, as old men or older men, how sweet it was when they crossed the Jordan. I just think that air was sweeter to their smell than anybody, right? Because they've been waiting for it for so long. They'd always believed that they could take the land. And just, you know, there are few things more wonderful to see than an old person who's excited. Maybe, you know, second to that would be a kid who's excited about something. But an older person who's really excited about something good and meaningful. Not excited because, you know, their check came in at the right time, a Medicare check or Social Security check. But I'm talking about something that's really substantial. You know, like, you know, some spiritual event or something like that. I mean, that's just that old faith is a beautiful thing.
Just in thinking about Joshua and Caleb having to endure that, perhaps they were angry and hostile and they had to overcome all that. I mean, I would be really ticked off.
Yeah.
Some of these
yes.
Going, I told you.
Yes.
Now I'm having to suffer.
Yes. Think about what bitterness and resentful does. It erodes your faith. But their faith was not eroded when they got to the Canaan land, was it? Matter of fact, Joshua puts them on his shoulders, right? God says, Joshua, it's on your shoulders now. That's a man of faith. And so bitterness and resentment had not ruined them. That's a great point. I'm with you. I'd have been so ticked off at the rest of them. Look what you've done to us, okay? Yes.
And Caleb, when he gets there, he still has to clear out his spot of what seems to be the biggest and worst of them all, in a sense.
Yeah.
At 80-some years old, he still has to do that.
But that's what he wants. Yeah. He wants the challenge. That's right. So, great man of faith. Yeah, exactly.
I was just thinking in the verse 33, and your children shall be shepherds in the wilderness for 40 years and shall suffer for your faithlessness.
Yes.
It's not their problem, but their suffering and consequences of their parents' sins. And so are Joshua and Caleb, so is Moses.
Right.
So many of the people who actually are faithful are still suffering for the faithlessness of others.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Also, Catherine and I were discussing this last night. We had read it, and just so often, I've heard it described how the Old Testament is like very similar to training mankind as children to maturity in the New Testament. And you can see the way that the children of Israel act. Is so similar to how kids act. Like, here, you just see a child who they were told, you need to do this. They refuse to do it. Then you reveal to them what the consequences are going to be. It's like, suddenly it's like, oh, we'll go do it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's too late.
Yeah, right.
You've already shown your disobedience and shown that you don't have the right attitude.
Right.
So the punishment is going to be there anyway.
Right. They try to take it anyway, and it's a flop. Yeah.
You
so
see
right.
That repeatedly.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple occasions. Yeah.
Very similar attitudes.
Yeah. After the calf and things like that. Yeah. And you're right that there's a difference between suffering in your guilt for your wrongdoing and suffering as a consequence of somebody else's wrongdoing. Those are both realities. And you see that there with that all those people that you listed. So the scouting thing appears to be just a disaster. But in the long run, it's all part of it. And we'll come back to that in just a second. The other development that's happening here, these next couple ones, they're happening all through the book of Numbers. There's just grumbling. What do the Israelites grumble about, by the way?
Everything.
Okay, we can go on now. Okay. Food, water, leadership. Okay, just everything. You can go back to Exodus. Where's Moses? He's been up there too long. I mean, just the grumbling is just going on and on and on and on. And I just think that all of us really are bad at this. And I know I catch myself grumbling, and I'm like, why am I grumbling? And it is such a thing we have to fight, and so forth. And then the idea of rebelling, I mean, there is the, even before this scout incident, what little rebellion incident was there, and it involved leprosy with Moses. And it was real personal with Moses, by the way. His own brother and sister think that, well, you're taking too much on. Who do you think you are? And God basically had to tell him, let me tell you who he is. He's my chosen leader. And this is where the comment is made about Moses. He's the meekest man. And that's why he's qualified to lead them. He's not the rash, hot-headed, ready to take on the Egyptian injustice at 40 guy. He's the 80-year-old shepherd who didn't want to do this job, but God wants him to, and so he's going to do it. So he's exactly qualified. And so the Moses and Miriam thing, and then, of course, we got the spy thing. And then after the spy thing, what's the other big rebellion incident in the next few chapters before we get, well, I don't think we've read that yet in our congregational reading.
Korah's rebellion.
Korah's rebellion, which actually there is an organized group of Levites that try to pull off a coup d'etat against Moses. Because if you look at the whole of things, it's not been going well. Moses' poll numbers are not good. Doing a good job or not a good job? His poll numbers are not good. So Korah and his cohort, see, they smell that. And so they try to pull off an insurrection. And basically, the earth opens up and swallows them. So that fixes that right there. So that's how that works out for Korah. So God is making it clear to these people, Moses is the leader. This is going the way I want it to go. Again, it's, you know, how is God judging things? He's judging things differently than the way they're judging things. So let's look at some themes and things that we see here in the purpose of the wilderness wandering. Let me give you this list here. First of all, what is really in great contrast in the book of Numbers and in this whole section, actually from Sinai to the threshold of Canaan, is that God's faithfulness is proven over and over and Israel's unfaithfulness is shown over and over. How had God shown his faithfulness?
By delivering from Egypt.
First of all, Egyptian deliverance.
Took care of all their grievances.
Right. Right. When they needed water, when they needed food, God had a way to provide it for them. From the water from the rock to the manna and on. Yeah. We're looking at the book of Numbers. What had the Numbers proven? They went down to Egypt, about 80 people.
But God is doing exactly what he said he
was. I'll make you a great nation. From one old man and his old wife having one little kid, I'll make you a great nation. And he does it. So the numbering. See, don't overlook the data parts of the Old Testament. Those heavy data sections, genealogies and numbers. Don't dismiss them. There's a reason why they're there. There are probably layers of reasons why they're there. The Israelites had not been faithful. How? What are some of the ways? How had they demonstrated their unfaithfulness? Okay, they had not been true to what God had commanded them about true worship back with the golden calf. What else?
Lack of faith,
mistrust. You've got us out here in the wilderness. The God who could do to Egypt what God did, could he not feed and water them? Of course he could. And he does. So, I mean, it's a lack of trust all the way through. And then the Canaan incident. Yes. What else, Daryl?
Just as far as numbering goes, in Numbers chapter 1, you know, it said there was 600,000 plus fighting men. Well, when they're renumbered, when the next generation is renumbered, there's again 600,000, almost exactly the same number. Mm-hmm. So God has exactly replaced the generation that died in the wilderness.
Yeah. Shows that God is going to fulfill making them a great nation. And it shows that he sustained them. They don't have a population drop. He sustains the population in the wilderness. Pretty good. the Israelites are ungrateful. They're rebellious. There's just so many ways in which they demonstrate their unfaithfulness. What we see here also in this wilderness part, and I would say the wilderness part, I would have you see it as very broad from the time they left Sinai, which is a year after they get delivered. They're at Sinai a year, by the way. A whole year. Until they get to the edge of the Canaan land. I think that's really the wilderness wandering period. And all through this, you see that God is giving them opportunities. He's providing for them. He's giving them guidance. He's giving them help. But he still expects some things for them. Again, this is a covenant. Remember, we emphasized this in the recent class. This is a covenant relationship. This is not all on God. They have a role in this to make this work. And he still expected them to trust and do certain things, like organize themselves as he instructed, the tabernacle construction, the tabernacle worship. Okay, now I'm going to lead you by the cloud. Let's follow the cloud. You know, they've got to pack up and go. There are things they have to do. Okay, which back to Zachary's point about the children, he's bringing them along and giving them things to do so they will mature. You know, he's not doing everything for them. He's giving them everything they need. And then he expects them to do certain things. And so put it this way. It's an incredible demonstration of parenting, what God does through this. But you know, the Israelites still mess up. And kids do. And it may or may not be a reflection of the parent. So, because Israelites have their own choice here, as people do. And this is, I think, at the heart of what's going on here. I got 2 points here that I think is at the heart of what's going on here. On the one hand, this looks like this is going in the wrong direction. I would have you see that it's going exactly in the direction God wants it to go in, because what God is doing is he's calling through these people. He's seeing who really is his people and who are not. Who's got the spirit and the trust that will be his people. Okay? God always ends up with a remnant. So we got this camp of Israelites. And over time, what's happening in this part of the Bible is that God is filtering. See who his people are. And in any camp of people that claim to be following God, God does the same thing. He's filtering. He's calling to see who his people really are or not. And what we're seeing here is that just being in the camp of the Israelites did not make them the true people of God. And that certainly has an application to the church, because that's how God works. You also see that in this whole process, a mediator was absolutely necessary. Moses steps in the gap, so to speak. He does it on two occasions, right? The golden calf and with this one. And he's mediating on the behalf of the people, but he also turns to the people and lets them have it from God's standpoint. But see how that the mediator is critical here. If, as the big picture is telling us, as we've emphasized, especially early in this class, this is all about God and people and God looking for his people, one of the motifs here that we see demonstrated is that there's a necessity for a mediator. In order for God and people to come together and humans and God to have a relationship, there's a need for a mediator. And who's the best mediator but one who is God? That comes in human flesh. So there you go. See how that's all prepping us. Okay. We see that God's blessings. I mean, this is an exciting time when they head out. When they head out of Sinai, this had to be an exciting time. It was exciting when they came out of Egypt, but you know, they're like in the middle of the night and they're grabbing everything they can get and they're just getting out of there. But this is like, okay, now they've caught their breath. They've been at Sinai. Everything's together. They know how to be God's people now. And here they go. And it gets spoiled because people are disobedient and things get jeopardized. But at the same time, it gets salvaged because of Caleb and Joshua and Moses and their role. And so really what's happening here is this is not merely about getting them to Canaan. I mean, we look at the maps and we look at all this information and we understand that he's trying to move these people from Egypt to Canaan and all this kind of, and that's part of the whole thing. But really, the essence of what's happening is he's trying to develop them as his faithful people. That's the real story here. And that's why all these things that happen, even the negative and the tragic things and the how people are showed the worst of themselves here, God takes all of that, he weaves all of that into this to develop his people. And just, we had some great discussion today about how that in the wilderness, look what this produces. It produces a faithful generation who's going to go in and by the hand of God, take on those Anak people and take on one of the most fortified cities of Canaan, right off the bat, Jericho. And the walls are going to fall. And so it's too easy to focus on those earthly things like they got to get to Canaan and he's got to get them in that land. No, the real journey was the journey of faith, of learning how to be people who trust and follow God. That's what God's looking for. That's the real story. All right, anything else?
Got another.
You make me think of God's synopsis of why he did all this in Deuteronomy 8, where it says, "And you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God has led you in the wilderness these 40 years, that he might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. And he humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that pertains or proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord."
Wow. Great. That's what Deuteronomy is. Deuteronomy is the reflection point. This is what it was all about. Okay, great. Thank you so much.